Hello, John Horgan.
Hey, George Johnson.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I've been very busy.
Yeah, I see that. You know, George, you've got to, I don't know, tweet me or wink at me or do something when you post on your new Discover blog, because just this morning at the last minute, I thought, oh yeah, George, he has this new blog. I should be looking at some of the things.
Oh,
he's
yeah,
written,
right.
Because I did see your Slate piece on cancer clusters and kind of riffing on Dan Fagan's new book about the Toms River cancer cases. That led me to back to your blog, and then I saw all these other things that you'd written.
Oh, yeah, I've been posting about two or three times a week, but yeah, I wish there were a way, you know, there probably is that I just don't know about, but, you know, where you could put people on an email list, so if you posted a blog post, it would automatically inform them.
I think I'll go and look for an RSS feed. I think that's what that does, right?
Do you use RSS?
I never have before, but I
don't either. I mean, I used to, and then I just kind of stopped using it, but it's apparently... I don't know. Yeah, I was looking. I didn't see, because a lot of times you'll see an RSS button, you know, up in the address bar, and I didn't, they don't seem to have that. But I should look into that.
Well, I tweet, every time I write something, I tweet about it, and people are...
I do that too. You just haven't been seeing my tweets.
Except then, I've fallen out of the habit of checking my tweet feed. For links, you know, I see things by people I know sometimes, but it's kind of random. I mean, unless you're checking all the time, they've already flowed past you, you know? So.
Yeah. Well, do you use the software called TweetDeck?
No, I don't.
God, I can't believe we're talking about this. Tweeting, TweetDeck.
Yeah.
It's actually good. You can either use it as a get it as a web page in your browser, or you can get a standalone free download, which works better. But basically, it lets you do things like create columns, and then if there's someone, like I have a column called Colleagues to Follow,
mm-hmm.
and whenever your tweets... that word. Whenever the messages that you send via Twitter come in, they automatically go in that column along with some other friends like Robert Wright and Dan Fagan.
Good idea.
Yeah.
You have an aversion to the actual word tweet?
Ugh, God. There's just something so undignified when I see my old newspaper, the New York Times, saying, you know, like, in a tweet from Cairo, you know, and it's like, it's the Twitter, it's like this corporation that's trademarked this name, and then everyone's giving them free advertising. It's not like blog post, you know, where it's this generic thing, or email. It would be like if a company early on had started and then named themselves email, and then somehow copyrighted the name or trademarked the name and patented the technology, and every time you sent an email, it would have to be capital E-M-A-I-L with the little R registered trademark in the circle, and then you would get free advertising every time someone referred to an email. I mean...
Oh, George, you big grouch. Well, the only problem I have with it is that to me, that the terms tweeting and Twitter evoke, I don't know, like a slumber party of 15-year-old girls. Not that there's anything wrong with 15-year-old girls, but you know what I mean? It like a lot of very fast-paced, high-pitched chatter.
Which is kind of what most of it is.
Yes, exactly.
I have learned to find, I mean, I really do check it every day, because the thing I found is it really is great for, you know, just the serendipity effect of being steered toward things you never would have known to read otherwise.
Or you find out that there's a...
And it's great for following. Yeah, before it's on the news.
Yeah, and... No, I have. I can't remember exactly what it was, but there have been a couple of times when I've seen something on a Twitter feed and I've written about it for Scientific American the day before the New York Times covers it, which is kind of cool.
Ah, yeah, it is. Yeah. No, it's definitely a valuable resource. I wish there was another name for it, or people could come up with something generic, you know, like, you know, when you're referring to RSS or you're referring to a text message, but just to have to use these terms, Twitter and tweet, just really.
It's good for you, George.
Yes, it makes me cringe, but it's too late now.
It softens your.
I said the same thing about.
It softens your grumpy old man image.
Yeah, no, it's really how I feel.
I know. Hey, but let's get the substance. Can you tell us? Yeah, give us the gist of your piece in Slate, because I thought that was really interesting.
Oh, well, thanks. Well, this is about cancer clusters, and as you can imagine, it's one of my favorite kind of phenomena where you have, you know, this data which may be random. In fact, it's going to be mostly random noise, and then you have to look at it and see if there's a signal there. In other words, you're looking at all of these correlations between cancers in a certain population, like in Toms River, New Jersey, or Woburn, Massachusetts, or Hinckley, California. And then you have to see in the data whether there's a statistically elevated number of cancer cases, and if that can be traced to a certain likely factor, like pollution in the water or the air or both.
Right.
And yet these signals are so weak that it's very easy to see order where there's really randomness. And
By the way, George, I have to say that I don't know if you invented this analogy, but I love your image of scattering a bunch of rice grains across a chessboard and then counting the grains that landed in each square as an analogy to cancer epidemiology. That was very so crisp and simple.
Versions of that have been used before, but it definitely stuck in my mind because, you really get this idea of random clustering.
Yes.
And yet some of the clustering's not going to be random. But what really struck me, and this was while I was writing my book, The Cancer Chronicles, I just finished doing the galley correction. So one more pass of the galleys, and then it's out to press. But anyway, while I was writing that, I got into reading about cancer clusters, and I was just amazed to learn, one, that the Aaron Brockovich case, that there was not a cancer cluster there, or at least one is yet to be found, even though there was certainly and is water pollution, and that in the United States, so far there's only two residential cancer clusters, mm-hmm. you know, that have been verified or not even verified, that have been linked very, very tentatively to a possible carcinogen. And one of those is Woburn, Massachusetts, and Toms River, New Jersey.
I found that really fascinating. I mean, I was astonished that, you know, I saw Aaron Brockovich, and I just thought it was such a wonderful, inspiring story of truth and goodness triumphing over greed and evil. And you're telling me that company was not guilty of poisoning the people.
Oh, no. Pacific Gas and Electric, they actually, you know, rather early on, they owned up to the fact that there was a plume of chromium 6 that had resulted in cooling water. Basically, they were using cooling water to cool this natural gas pumping facility out in the Mojave Desert. And then when the water was used, it would go into an evaporative pond, but it was unlined, so the water leaked down and got into the aquifer. So there was definitely higher concentrations of chromium 6, which is the bad kind of chromium. Chromium 3 is actually, they put it in vitamin pills because it's supposed to be an essential nutrient. But chromium 6 has been shown, at least when you breathe it, to be carcinogenic. Mm-hmm. It's less clear if that's true when it's dissolved in water for various reasons that I've gotten into in my blog post and will be getting into further. But So the pollution was there, but when they've done the epidemiology, on the most recent report was published in 2011, there was no elevated cancer rate. In fact, it was slightly but not significantly lower than that for the general population.
Yeah, that really surprised me, because, and I'm sure it would surprise most people, because the assumption in the movie was that the Aaron Brockovich is talking to these people who have these terrible diseases, yeah, and that it was caused by the bad guys. I would assume that this is also true. I mean, George, I feel like you need to look at fracking and the epidemiology linking or not linking the distribution of fracking wells to various problems that people are reporting. Mm. So you're saying you can have – yeah, you can definitely – trace certain kinds of pollution to some of these industrial processes and plants and so forth. But then when you go another step and try to link the presence of pollution to specific diseases and especially cancer, that often that is extremely difficult and the evidence is really weak. I mean –
Yeah, I mean, something can be a carcinogen, and yet the question is whether in the quantity that you're getting it, say, as a resident living by a toxic waste dump, it's still, even though it's going to be higher than it should be, it's still going to be very, very, very dilute.
Right.
And so cancer clusters, most things that have been linked to cancer through epidemiology have been industrial, workplace cancer clusters, where they find that workers in mines throughout the world who are exposed to a lot of asbestos are getting mesothelioma or
how about radon?
Certain other radon, or uranium miners and radon. I mean, radon's not nearly as bad as it seems from, it's not as bad as it sounds like from the average article you read warning you about getting your radon test.
Well, what I remember, I looked into radon when I was buying a house in the early 90s because it was a big deal there and you were supposed to hire radon testers
here too.
And so I actually did an article for Scientific American because I wanted to understand the science myself. And what I found was that the studies linking radon to higher cancer rates were of these miners who were exposed to extremely high levels, but it tended to be only miners who also smoked.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they try to adjust for that in the epidemiology, but in those studies, a lot of times they didn't even have information on whether miners smoked. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I bet it's pretty hard to find a uranium miner, at least back then, that doesn't smoke. So.
Right.
So you can take that into account in the epidemiology, but still, it's questionable. And then you're stuck with these numbers, and you have to assume that you can extrapolate linearly mm-hmm. from exposure in the workplace to exposure in the home. I mean, radon is a lot more likely than a lot of carcinogenic exposures, just because you get a chronic daily dose of
right.
it. Yeah. If you have radon. But again, can you really extrapolate from miners down to the general public? And there's actually a really good epidemiological study that took place in the state of Iowa, which has the highest radon concentrations. And there they found correlations that were the same as those extrapolated from the miner data.
Well, this gets back to something I think we might have talked about when we were talking about nuclear energy and the dangers of radiation, and even after experiments
yeah.
like Fukushima, whether or not you have this kind of linear dose response effect, so that if X amount of radiation kills this proportion of people, whether you can scale that down right down to zero
yeah.
and there will still always be some smaller percentage of people dying, even if it's just a tiny bit of above zero. And it turns out that
yeah.
there's usually some kind of threshold below which really there's no effect established at all.
It's controversial because the assumption for most radiation epidemiologists is that the dose is linear because you know, even if you have a very small dose, if you get an alpha particle striking the DNA of one of your cells, you know, it's going to cause, you know, very possibly cause genetic damage, or it's going to zip through the cytoplasm and create oxygen-free radicals that will, you know, add to the corrosion of the genome. So, but on the other hand, there's this whole school of thought of something called radiation hormesis, mm-hmm. which actually, you know, posits that at very low doses, radiation has beneficial effects,
right.
which is, as you can imagine, really controversial. I get into all this in my book. In fact, I have a chapter where I describe getting a radon test done at my house, and then this causing me to actually unpack the statistics and see where these numbers come from. And I mean, one of the most striking things is you'll often see something like, what's the number? Off the top of my head, I'm thinking it's 73,000 people a year die of lung cancer that's linked to radon.
Right.
I mean, and but then when you look down in the footnotes, which usually doesn't get into the press releases from the Environmental Protection Association, you find out that that 90% of those cancers were also linked to some degree or another with smoking cigarettes.
Right.
So
all these confounding factors.
Yeah, exactly. So that, you know, it certainly adds to your. And then to get back to Brockovich. So, and I want to mention this because there was a report last week on PBS Frontline, this two-part series by Miles O'Brien, and I couldn't believe it. He actually went back to Hinckley, California, the site of Aaron Brockovich, and used it for this story about chromium 6 and how dangerous it is, and how the EPA has been really dragging its feet and tightening up the standard to the level that it's been tightened in California. And for the most part, or for the, say, let's say the three-fourths part, it's a really good two-part series, but he starts out with this scene where he's like driving around Hinckley with this resident who was, she was actually the woman who was said to have originally approached the real Aaron Brockovich about this problem, or this perceived problem. And, I mean, again, it's not that there was a problem with the pollution, but, you know, it's not at all clear that there was any cancer caused by the pollution. But anyway, so he's driving around Miles O'Brien with this woman, and they're looking at the different houses that were purchased by Pacific Gas and Electric, who had bought up houses from people, and then basically raised them or boarded them up, and that was actually even before the settlement was underway. It was doing that, which obviously made people suspicious, rightfully so. And then there's a point where, you know, he's showing like water, you know, coming out of sprinklers in the city park, and talking about how the water contains hexavalent chromium or chromium 6, and that hexavalent chromium causes cancer. You know, flat out statement. And then he cuts to this scene from the movie where Julia Roberts, playing Aaron Brockovich, is scrambling across down into a irrigation ditch to take water samples, and then it cuts to her pulling a dead frog out of an evaporated swimming pool.
Right.
And he never gets back any place in the two-part story and tells you that the epidemiology has not shown that there's any cancer that was caused by chromium 6 in Hinckley. I mean,
Jesus.
It's really, really misleading. What's
upsetting about this, George, is that for a kind of green lefty like me, it suggests that a lot of the ferocious criticism against some of these gigantic, reckless, polluting companies was unfair.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You can say it's clear that pollution's a bad thing, okay? I mean, we can stipulate that dumping of toxic waste into public aquifers and the air is a bad thing, and that many of these companies were definitely guilty of that, and they deserve to have to pay some kind of settlement. And like in Toms River, for example, there were two official Superfund sites. There's no question, and Dan documents this really well in his book about Toms River, that, you know, there's just no question there was just egregious, irresponsible pollution.
Dan, we're talking
when
about
you get down to what
we should just identify.
Yeah, Tom's River.
Yeah, and
Tom's
Dan,
River.
Dan Fagan's new book, which is called
Tom's River.
Oh, that's the title. Oh, okay.
That's the title. Yeah, Story of Science and Salvation. And then I think if people will read my piece in Slate, it's kind of like an essay on cancer clusters, but it's focused on Dan's book.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like I could do a straight review because, you know, both of us, I mean, you and I both know Dan, and we were all Templeton Cambridge journalism fellows that wonderful 3 months in England. Mm-hmm. And you know, Dan's a friend and one of the best environmental journalists in the country, mm-hmm. hands down. And I think it's clear from my review essay that I think the book is just really, really good and really, really admirable. But in the end, when he walks us through the whole story, I come out not believing that there really was a childhood leukemia cluster in Tom's River. And when you look at the numbers, it comes down to, I mean, a huge amount of the case basically hinged on looking at, say, 8 mothers who were exposed during pregnancy to the highest levels of water from one of the wells that supplied Tom's River, and certain contaminants had been found in the well. And so there were 8 mothers, and they gave birth to daughters. And 5 of those girls ended up getting leukemia, and 3 of the girls did not. But to get to this number, first they started looking at, you know, boys and girls together, and they couldn't find a statistically meaningful so-called correlation. So then they thought, well, what happens if we just look at the girls? So
yeah.
There's 2 ways you can look at the story. One is that the epidemiologists were just like narrowing in and finding this very subtle little signal, you know, that indicated the truth. It was hidden by all this noise. Or you can also look at it is that they were like basically slicing the data this way and that until they found something that hinted at a possible correlation between leukemia and pollution. And in this case, the state concluded with, quote, considerable uncertainty that they found data supporting the hypothesis that the leukemia had been linked to the pollution. But you know, we don't really know one way or the other whether anyone got cancer in Tom's River from the pollution.
Where did he come out?
Dan's very persuaded by the data, mm-hmm. and what he calls like the overall preponderance of the data, because they had all of these little correlations that pointed to this one well and not to the other wells. So that definitely makes you wonder. But almost all of those correlations had to be put to the side or discarded because they weren't statistically significant.
Right.
But again, that's a hairy issue because something can be statistically significant and not really be significant in the way that you and I and everyone uses the word. Mm-hmm. And something can fail the test and be statistically insignificant, except something real still could be going on.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much noise in the signals, and you get down to a cancer cluster, you're not talking about thousands of children or hundreds of children. At most, maybe dozens of children over a period of more than a decade in a population of 70 or 80,000.
Right.
And so, again, it's a tragedy if any of those kids got leukemia who wouldn't have otherwise from this pollution. But it's almost impossible to say one way or the other. And in this case, just like it did with Aaron Brockovich and just like it did with the civil action, which was Woburn, Massachusetts, it came out to, you know, settling out of court because, you know, I think the lawyers knew that it could go either way before a judge. And, of course, the companies wanted to get this out of their way.
Sure.
And, again, these companies deserve to pay for the pollution.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't defend them at all, but it's just not clear that this was a source of cancer.
That's science with real consequences. And I thought your piece in Slate, you know, there's so much emotion that's brought to bear in cases like this, and you know, people's politics, certainly my politics affect how I view some of these cases. I mean, you want to root for the little people against the bad guy, but but you know, it's so important to really go with what the data tell us. So
And how do you do that? I mean, you know, it's just so disheartening sometimes. Like this morning, the first thing I see when I check my email is a comment on my blog about Aaron Brockovich. You know, just this really sarcastic thing saying like, well, oh, this is just what we need, more crusading journalists like you. How about this? Every day from now on for 20 years, you drink a glass of water with hexavalent chromium just to show us all how safe it is.
Right.
Which is completely not what I said.
Yeah.
You know, nowhere do I say that hexavalent chromium is good for you.
Right.
Or even that it's not carcinogenic, at least when breathed. But you can't say these things no matter how measured you are, no matter how much you give the analysis, and you still get blowback from people that say that you're, you know, supporting the evil corporation.
Sure, that's inevitable. Hey, George, maybe we should switch to something that is a little less controversial.
Yeah.
I just wrote an article. I mean, I started working on the goddamn thing probably, I don't know, 18 months ago for National Geographic.
Oh.
And it finally came out. This is, I'm just holding up the cover spread. It's called The Drones Come Home. And I just wanted to let people know that this thing finally came out. It was really a lot of fun to write, and the focus is on not the military drones, which have been covered to death, but on how this drone technology now appears to be migrating to the United States, and or it's poised to migrate here. There are a lot of law enforcement agencies and other groups who are just dying to get their hands on this technology. And so I talk about some of the technological issues that are involved here, the privacy issues, political. The Obama administration really wants to help drones come to the United States and has pledged to ease restrictions of the Federal Aviation Administration to make it easier to get licenses to operate drones in U.S. airspace. Now they are severely restricted. And already there are civil rights groups who are really worried about this. There are some communities that have already tried to prohibit law enforcement agencies from having drones in their communities. And I think it's going to happen. But my hope is, and this is what I say in the article, is that people are aware of this happening and get involved in the process of regulating the use of drones in U.S. airspace so that they don't become invasive and don't start spying even on innocent people, and so that they don't become armed, because that's one of the questions. Should these domestic drones not only be equipped with surveillance equipment, but should they also have explosives on them, or maybe some kind of firearm, so that they can shoot people, bad guys?
I was just amazed by this article. I read it as soon as it came out, and I had been completely ignorant of the whole issue of civilian drones being used by police departments in the United States. It's stunning stuff.
Well, it's happening on a very tiny scale now. I actually hung out for 3 or 4 days with a group of sheriffs in Grand Junction, Colorado. I think they were the first law enforcement agency to get permission from the FAA to fly drones in any significant way. And it's basically because there's nothing out there. And, you know, you've got these very broad, unimpeded views. And I think also the FAA wanted to let these guys try out the drones and see what happened. It's sort of a trial, an experiment, and see what the local blowback, if any, is. It's a very attractive bunch of guys. They're sort of good old boys. And they say they just want the drones to find little kids who've wandered away from their parents or lost hikers. And things like that. But it, you know, they all may also come in handy for tracking fugitives. So, and they say they're not interested at all in having drones that are armed. But meanwhile, you know,
so
there's
purely for surveillance. I'm sorry. Yeah. Purely for surveillance. Okay.
That's right. But even the surveillance technologies are incredibly sophisticated. So, you know, there are all these hobby drones out there already, but they have, you know, generally you have to fly them with a joystick, and it's got to be line of sight. What's amazing about these new drones that are inspired by some of the technology developed by the military is that they've got a lot of intelligence built into them. So this drone that I was flying, for example, that was designed and built by a retired Air Force captain who was based in Denver, you can operate it with a laptop or a handheld device like an iPad or something, and it'll have a Google map or some other map image on your device, and you can just click on any spot on the map, and the drone will automatically, without you doing anything, without using a joystick or so forth, will fly to that spot, and then again you click another command and it'll circle the spot, or you can have two spots on the map and the drone will go back and forth between them again automatically. You can obviously adjust the elevation to any figure that you like, and so it's, they're amazingly versatile. They are, actually, it was a little tricky for me to use. That this guy who invented this thing was bragging about how any idiot could operate it, and then he gave it to me, and of course I found a way almost to crash the damn thing because I hit the wrong button, which was very embarrassing. I actually had that in the original draft of my article, how I opened with me almost crashing the drone, and this guy is yelling at me behind me. But editor decided in his wisdom that would be either unfair to me or to the designer of this drone.
That would have been great. Yeah, I can see his point, but you could use that like as a blog post or something.
Yeah, maybe
you?
I should. The original draft had a lot more instances of drones basically fucking up. I also went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where there's a lot of drone research going on, and I went into this laboratory where they're working on all these fancy navigation systems. One of the technical issues involves trying to find navigation systems that are not based on GPS, because GPS it can be vulnerable in certain situations. There was this highly publicized case more than a year ago where a CIA drone was brought down in Iran, and the Iranians captured it and then showed it on television, and it was very embarrassing for the CIA. And the story was that the Iranians had hacked into the GPS navigation system of the drone, and they fooled it and got it to land in Iran instead of its CIA base. And so now the Air Force is trying to develop alternative navigation systems. And so I was in this lab, and they were showing off this new navigation system with a little quad rotor, one of these drones that has four little rotor blades on each corner. And it was funny because the thing crashed the first three times the guy tried to show me how it worked, and he'd been giving me this big riff about how our essential mission is reliability and safety and everything like that. This thing was crashing into walls and flipping over and so forth before he finally got it straightened out. And I also report on how with the military drones, and I hadn't been aware of this before I did the article, there have been many crashes and accidents involving the big expensive drone systems, the Predator and the Global Hawk, which cost tens of millions of dollars and are loaded with very expensive equipment. And so obviously, you know, if you're talking about having these things in domestic airspace, you really need them to work very well. You don't want them to be crashing onto people's houses and so forth. So there are some technical.
They'd be flying.
Yeah, sir.
Yeah, I'm sorry. They'd be flying fairly low.
Well, it could be low, high. I mean, they're what's amazing is I actually use the term speciation event to describe what's happening with drones because there are so many different kinds. One of the interesting trends, and this is basically being promoted by DARPA, which is putting up a lot of money for this, is really tiny drones that look like bugs or birds. So these would be drones that hide in plain sight, and you know they're supposed to fool people. You know, they could be just so small that you don't notice them, but they could also be designed to look like moths. And I actually saw a drone that looked like a moth, or hummingbirds. There's been a lot of publicity given to this hummingbird drone, and the whole point is so that you know they could be ubiquitous, flying all over the place, and people don't even know they're being spied on. Now there are some really significant technical obstacles to that. Probably the biggest one is to have a battery that's powerful enough so that you can have, let's say, one of these little hummingbirds flying around for an hour or a couple of hours. Now I think they can only stay aloft for a few minutes in general.
They use as much energy as a hummingbird.
Yeah, but there's a lot of money flowing into this. And the the Air Force is a little careless in its publicity. I saw when I was at Wright-Patterson, I went to this facility for testing mini drones, and they did a lot of classified work there, and they didn't want to show me an actual demonstration of one of their test drones. So instead, they showed me a video that I posted this on my Scientific American blog site. The video basically shows and talks in very enthusiastic terms these little tiny drones. They actually kind of look like cell phones with wings, kind of a weird hybrid between a cell phone and a dragonfly. And there's a plane that's flying over a city, and this is all animated. The belly of the plane opens up, and this horde of these little tiny drones flies out of the city. And then you follow some of them down into the city, and they are perching on windowsills and on power lines, and they're looking at potential bad guys walking down the streets, and they're following them, stalking them into buildings. And then at the very end, one of these little winged drones flies up behind some supposed bad guy. He's wearing civilian clothes and shoots him in the back of the head. And this is produced by the Air Force.
My God. I missed that video. I got to go back and look at this.
So, and another trend that's interesting is, and this is something we need to be worried about, the United States is showing how powerful this technology can be, especially with its military applications. And so there are more than 50 other countries around the world that are now pursuing drone technology on their own. So there's this tremendous new arms race going on, and we have to fear being attacked by drones. There are some militant groups like Hezbollah that also have their own drones. And so one of the newest trends in drone technology is drones that kill other drones. And I talked to a guy, a software developer from a company called Proceris, who is working on this. And the idea is that you have drones that can recognize even very small drones and either crash into them, or they have some kind of little firearm or missile that can shoot down the other drone. And this is something that the United States is very sort of quietly very worried about. And I actually saw a video taken from an exercise. It's called Black Dart, in which a drone penetrated some U.S. facility. I wasn't told what the facility is. It's like you're sitting on the back of the drone and you're flying into the space, and suddenly you see this little puff of smoke on the ground in front of you, and then you see this, it's like a little dot getting bigger and bigger, and then it whizzes past you, and the guy who showed me the video said, that was a surface-to-air missile trying to shoot the drone down and then failing. And then you see a bigger thing whizzing past, and that was an F-16 trying to figure out where the drone was. So, you know, so these things right now, you've got some little tiny drones that can pack a big explosive. There's a drone called the Switchblade that's already been developed for U.S. Armed Forces. In fact, especially for commando missions, it's only about the size of a loaf of French bread. And again, it can be controlled with one of these little, with a handheld device, and you can send it over hills and just X marks the spot, and it'll fly exactly to that spot and then detonate a grenade there. And obviously, this is something that other people can use against us. You know, I'm hoping that I kind of scared people.
I mean, just add the whole new dimension to the debate.
Yeah.
I mean, very literally. Yeah. It's very tiny, tiny dimensions. And that's something that just really, just really blew me away, because I hadn't thought about the idea of that kind of scale.
Right. Well,
The hummingbird drones that you can't even see from 20 feet away. And
on the other side, there are, I think just on the drawing boards immense drones that are basically like a gigantic flying solar panel, maybe wings, very lightweight wings, maybe 400 or 500 feet wide, that can stay up for months at a time, that use virtually no energy at all, and are loaded with surveillance equipment. And so basically it's like a really low cost and highly maneuverable spy satellite.
I see.
And I think that's just going to happen. Because it's going to be so cheap that it's going to be irresistible for militaries. And the question is, again, how should it be regulated so it does what we want it to do and doesn't have a significant downside?
Yeah. So the limiting factor now is really, the smaller you get them, the more, both useful and nefarious it seems they can be, and yet you have the energy constraint.
Right.
So, I mean, even if it's solar, you need so many, square centimeters of space to, for your solar cell to capture the light.
Yes.
And turn it into electricity. And of course, batteries can only get so small and hold a charge for a certain time. I mean, they must be looking into nuclear power sources, something like they use in satellites, where you don't have a nuclear reactor, but you have a radioisotopes that are emitting energy, and that this energy is then harnessed. But that's pretty low power applications, I guess.
Well, yeah, and I would imagine there would be severe regulatory issues that come up with nuclear-powered drones flying. I assume there's a lot of classified work I certainly wasn't privy to. A fascinating dimension of this is also the surveillance technology. I did an article for Scientific American about 20 years ago on an imaging technology that supposedly could see through walls and ceilings, could detect human figures. One of the technologies people were developing was just detecting the Doppler signal from a beating human heart. So, you can't actually see the outline of a figure, but you can see that particular signal behind walls. And I was told by two different people, I couldn't get details on it, but that technology is already available and could be mounted on drones, so that you don't only have to have a clear line of sight to people that you're trying to track, but you can also see people inside buildings and so forth. Which to me is fascinating. So a drone is just like a platform for all these different possible technologies. Just in terms of the infrared, the drone that I was playing around with and almost crashed in Colorado had a video camera, a daylight video camera, optical range, and also an infrared camera. And the infrared camera was like military grade. And just to show me how powerful it was, the guy who designed the plane told me, he pointed the camera at me and he said, put your hand on your shirt, just press it there and take it away immediately. And so I did that. And then he showed me, he captured an image and then showed it to me on his laptop, an image that had been taken with his infrared camera. And there was a bright handprint on my T-shirt where my hand had been just for an instant, but it left this very, very distinct heat signature.
Whoa.
And so obviously it would be, you know, if you're using these to track people at night, you'd get a really bright signature.
It's just fascinating.
Yeah, it's very cool stuff. So.
Oh yeah, I mean it's one of these things where you know you can't help but think how really important and useful these applications could be if they're in the hands of uncorruptibly good people who don't make a lot of mistakes.
Well, and here's the thing,
that,
George.
Of course, is always the catch.
Yeah, drones have already been used by human rights groups. They can be used to monitor farms, to get data from, let's say, you know, like a Fukushima style nuclear reactor. It would have been great to have drones to fly over there to gather information, something like the oil spill in the Gulf. They've already been used for archaeological research, for border patrol, which is more in the law enforcement agencies that realm. This could be a wonderful technology. I mean, it already is.
Yeah, because you could be reducing risk to human life. Like, I'm thinking like around here and around Santa Fe in the mountains, every summer there's one or two incidences with a hiker getting lost way up in the wilderness, you know, above way, you know, 11,000, 12,000 feet. And there was an incident, a few years ago where the rescue plane trying to rescue her, you know, they'd spotted her somehow, and the plane crashed and killed the pilot.
And the girl
he had just rescued.
Oh my God!
But then again, you know, you would have had to you know, you couldn't use a drone to go pick up the hiker and bring her back to civilization. But you know, maybe you could drop off supplies to get through the night.
Right, and you can tell the rescuers exactly where they have to go. Yeah,
and tell the rescuers where to go by land so you're not flying an airplane in iffy conditions right up against mountain peaks.
Yeah, it's, you know, planes and helicopters are extremely expensive, and you need trained pilots who are extremely expensive, the training and so forth. And, so just in terms of the cost, drones are really have an enormous advantage. So
So
we'll see. And listen, you know, in terms of drones being armed, I can imagine a situation where, let's say you got a bad guy who's in a bank or in a building somewhere and he's barricaded and he's got some hostages. I mean, really, wouldn't it be fantastic if you could fly a little tiny drone in there that hits him with a knockout dart or even puts a bullet in his head? I mean,
When you have these crisp, unambiguous situations like that.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Wow.
Okay. So
this is interesting because you've written very bitingly about military drones. But, it sounds like in this case, you know, you can see how, you know, if properly implemented and regulated, you know, the civilian applications could outweigh the bad.
Yeah.
Or at least that it's worth entertaining that possibility.
Sure. I mean, first of all, I don't think you can ban a technology like this outright, and especially not when everybody
it's
else
gonna happen.
In the world is
it's happening.
Is trying, it's a matter of trying to use it in the best possible way. But, again, in an original version of my draft, I used the term technological determinism, which mm-hmm. I have heard attributed to Torstein Veblen, this cranky old
Veblen?
Economist,
wow.
But I found that on Wikipedia, and then I couldn't get a good, solid confirmation.
Yeah.
So I decided not to use it in the article, but it's a wonderful term, and mm-hmm. It describes something very real, where certain technologies have this momentum of their own and seem to self-perpetuate regardless of really whether they benefit humans.
Actually,
Marshall McLuhan had this wonderful idea. He's trying to express the basic idea of technological determinism. He once said that humans are the sex organs of machines.
I see. So,
machines just use us to propagate.
And,
you know, probably the most striking example of this is nuclear weapons, where you got the proliferation of this technology that could absolutely wipe out its creators.
I've actually just been reading this new biography of Robert Oppenheimer, and just being reminded all over again of that period right after the success of the Trinity nuclear test and the fruit of the Manhattan Project, and then the days between that and the decision to use it in Japan, and the position of the scientists. Before and after that, you know, on what to do with, in the aftermath, and with a lot of people saying that this was important to immediately share this technology with our then ally, the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and that this in the long run would be this great thing to do that would help ensure world peace. So, of course, instead we went the opposite way and got the Cold War. But then you read about what was going through people's minds like Truman and his people, and, you know, here they see the Soviet Union already, you know, expanding its hegemony into Poland and the whole Iron Curtain speech coming then with Churchill and Fulton, Missouri, and then it just kind of escalates from there. And then, of course, as soon as the Soviets then, even though they're not officially given the secrets, of course, you know, this is just physics. You know, that's what Oppenheimer and all these people were saying. There are no secrets to the nuclear bomb. Mm-hmm. You know, people are going to figure out how to do it. And then, of course, sure enough, the Soviet Union explodes first an A bomb and then an H bomb. Mm-hmm. And to people like, you know, Oppenheimer and most of his colleagues, you know, except Edward Teller, you know, they're saying that, wow, you know, this just shows that we were right all along. We should have shared this with the Soviet Union. And of course, for Truman and his people, it's like, well, good thing we didn't listen to Oppenheimer, that commie, and or they'd be even further along than they are now. It's just fascinating seeing the beginnings of that whole Cold War mentality. It was just so destructive.
Well, George, I'm really scared that we're seeing the beginning of that again. I see it with the way that our use of drones, you know, I've just been saying how I think there can be an upside to this technology, but I am really worried at this idea of an international arms race, which is underway right now and can really come back to bite us, because any idiot can acquire this technology. It's not like nuclear weapons. I'm also really worried about the escalation of rhetoric surrounding cyber warfare, and we're accusing the Chinese of attacking us, and there are all these different groups now that are lobbying for a huge buildup in cybersecurity in this country, and of course that means developing offensive cyber warfare capabilities as well. And the United States, under the Obama administration, has already said that it reserves the right to attack with real weapons that blow people up when it has sustained a cyber attack from some bad guy.
So you have two more levels of an arms race, and then on top of it, you still have a version of the nuclear arms race.
Yeah, so, I mean, it just takes some it's we've seen this happen over and over again. At what point, we've just been through these two devastating wars that really rocked our economy, have really hurt us badly. And, you know, when are we going to get together with these other countries and figure out a way to stop this? You know, because there must be a way to do that and get out of this endless cycle of escalation of military innovation. It's because it's so stupid and destructive.
God, it's hard to be optimistic.
I still am optimistic, if only because, you know, we just went through the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, and my hope is that the lesson we've learned is how counterproductive military intervention is, and that we have to find ways to resolve some of these problems nonviolently. And, you know, there's some bad people out there, North Korea, and, you know, the president of Syria is really obviously a bad actor, very violent, but you know, this should be the great challenge of U.S. government, I think, especially people involved in foreign policy, is to figure out how to solve these problems without these old so-called solutions that just perpetuate the problem or push it off into
falling back into the same patterns.
And, yeah.
Yeah, it's the same Cold War mentality with just new players, and then, as you say, potentially many more new players, because it just lowers the bar of entry.
Well, I gave...
God, yeah, you're really scaring me.
Well, I gave a talk, I floated the idea very tentatively, that scientists and engineers should consider not being involved in any research that could have military applications, and that we should have a moratorium, because the relentless drive toward military innovation might give us short-term advantages, as it clearly has with drones, and I think probably also in cyber warfare. But long-term, these technologies are destabilizing and make the world a more dangerous place and undermine our security. So, you know, you don't even have to look at it as a moral issue. You look at it in strictly practical terms, and I think there are good reasons for saying that this particular kind of research and development, we need to find a way to stop it.
Yeah.
Bad chance.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing, because even if you get this, you know, some kind of, you know, significant widespread pledge among scientists not to take military funding, well, it'd be very difficult because, you know, just the scramble for getting money for research, you know, both good research and some research just to, you know, build your own personal dynasty.
Yeah, right.
You know, through a laboratory, and, you know, it's a mixed thing. But, and then it comes back to the technological imperative, as you say, that somehow the technology, you know, figuratively finds a way to reproduce through willing people, because, you know, you can easily say a significant number of scientists in the United States signed and followed this pledge, you know, you're going to have no trouble finding scientists from outside of the country who are going to come here and be happy to have a chance to improve their own lives in the short run by getting access to the government grants and research money.
I suppose so. I would think that if a few elite institutions, and again, this is highly implausible, but if you had elite scientists and elite institutions shunning this kind of research, that might pressure other, you know, less elite scientists and schools and so forth do the same. One thing I'm really worried about, I think we've talked about this before, is the degree to which neuroscientists are going after military money now. DARPA is funding a lot of research on neuroscience, and some of the implications of that are really creepy and scary. Bionic soldiers and
the virtual battlefield and
that kind of stuff.
Cranial stimulation.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
but you know, this is just exactly what Oppenheimer and Robert Serber and so many of the scientists you know, back right after the Manhattan Project were trying to, you know, convince the powers that be, and if anything, it's a, you know, it's a steeper slope now than it was then.
Yeah, I keep waiting for human reason to prevail against some of these very deep-rooted, darker tendencies. And I'm still hopeful, you know?
Good.
We'll see.
Good.
Just because I choose to be.
I'll try to be hopeful, too.
All right, George, we've used up an hour.
Hey, we hit it almost exactly. We should go with this.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds good. So, same time next month?
Yeah, or maybe a little earlier. We kind of fell off our schedule, so maybe we should like gradually get back toward earlier in the month. And
okay, next month is a lot lighter.
So it's not to shortchange all 16 viewers.
Okay, sounds good, George.
Okay,
I'll talk to you soon.
See you soon.